de tout.
Have fun.
Hey, you're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Revolutionary greetings to all of you, brothers and sisters. I am Siegfried, and this is Back in the USSR, where we are marking the 100th anniversary of an event which may very well be the most significant in modern times, the Russian Revolution of 1917, and specifically the seizure of power by the Bolshevik Party led by Vladimir Lenin in what became known and celebrated as Red October. Now, and of course, I should explain that the theme of the show, the song which I begin the show with every week, is actually the Soviet National Anthem. And this particular recording of the Soviet National Anthem from the occasion of the 60th anniversary of the October Revolution, as it was played in Red Square in 1977, during the parade which was held annually. To mark the anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution in the Soviet Union. Now, the world's first socialist revolution That was what the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 was. It was the world's first socialist revolution and a true historical milestone for countless millions of working and oppressed people all over the world, not just in Russia. There's a reason why the young Soviet state had to face invasion by no less than 14 foreign armies, barely a year after the revolution even happened. Because the establishment of a new society, a new and competing order that stood against the status quo of global capitalism and global imperialism, could not be tolerated by the powers that be. Just as they could not tolerate the Chinese Revolution of 1949, the Cuban Revolution of 1959, and any number of other successful revolutions in Vietnam, Korea, Angola, Grenada, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Nicaragua, Burkina Faso, Guinea-Bissau, Laos, Yemen, and many, many others, all of which owed something to the revolutionary example of 1917, and all of which were attacked and besieged by the United States and its allies. 1917 was a turning point for working class people, but it was also a turning point for colonized peoples, suffering under the boot heel of European empires, showing them what could be achieved when oppressed people rise up, take control, and run things for themselves. It was not only about working people liberating themselves from the control of the bosses, landlords, and capitalist exploiters, but also about colonized peoples overthrowing the imperialist, overthrowing the colonizer, and securing their own genuine self-determination and self-rule. Tonight is the first in a series of shows where I'm going to attempt to explain these things and why, 100 years later, the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 still matters and still inspires millions of people all over the world to take action against oppressors and exploiters. For 1917 showed that no ruling class is invincible. However brutal it is and however deeply entrenched it is, it can be overthrown. And 1917 also showed that arisen people can't control their own destiny. And this is very important to understand. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. We'll be right back. listening to Back in the USSR here in 93.3 FM CFRU, and that of course was the International in Russian, the Russian version of the International, that iconic song, anthem of working class militancy the world over, and working class unity the world over, in resistance against capitalism, against exploitation, and against ultimately all of the different forces which do oppress and exploit the peoples of the world. Now, and of course, it's very important to point this out, like, because of course, one of the most important contributions that the Bolshevik Revolution and the Soviet Union made was with regard to the worldwide struggle against colonialism. And of course, I should also say that the other song I played before then was that instrumental piece was from Georgi Sviridov, a Soviet composer, and it was called Time Forward, you know, talking about historical progress and how, once again, how working class and oppressed people can take control of their own destiny and seize it from the hands of oppressors and exploiters. And this can be done. But like I said before, one of the most important contributions that the Bolshevik Revolution and the Soviet Union made was with regard to the worldwide struggle against colonialism. When the revolution triumphed in October 1917, most of the rest of the world was colonized by the United Kingdom, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Spain, and the United States. But under the leadership of Vladimir Lenin, the revolution became the inspiration for countless peoples, not only by showing that a workers' state was possible, but also by providing practical, material, and later military aid to people fighting for their own liberation around the world. The first example was in the liberation of the colonies held by Tsarist Russia itself, which was known as a prison house of nations. That's how Lenin described Tsarist Russia. The new Soviet Union, by contrast, would be a federation of different nationalities, each having guaranteed political, economic, linguistic, and cultural rights. And that would be a whole other show, but I mean, the various nationalities in the Soviet Union actually had, like, far more guaranteed rights in all those areas. Than the oppressed nationalities in Canada today enjoy, specifically Indigenous people. Now, the years following World War I, which had been a murderous struggle between rival colonial empires, various anti-colonial and revolutionary uprisings began to occur. In 1919, the people of Egypt and Iraq rose up against British rule. The Koreans fought Japanese occupation, and a revolution in Hungary resulted in the short-lived Hungarian Soviet Republic. The Congress of Peoples of the East of 1920, or the Baku Congress, was an attempt by Lenin's Bolsheviks to build a revolutionary Marxist movement of the exploited and oppressed peoples of the colonial world, while at the same time appealing to the advanced countries, especially in Europe, to lend support to these movements. Some 1,891 delegates attended the Congress from over 25 countries, including Turkey, Persia, Egypt, India, Afghanistan, China, Japan, Korea, Syria, and Palestine. The final manifesto read in part, quote, "Here in Baku, on the borders of Europe and Asia, we representatives of tens of millions of peasants and workers of Asia and Africa in revolt, showed the world our wounds, showed the world the marks of the whip on our backs, the traces left by the chains on our feet and hands. And we raised our daggers, revolvers, and swords and swore before the world that we would use these weapons not to fight each other, but to fight the capitalists, believing profoundly that you, the workers of Europe and Asia, will unite with us under the banner of the Communist International for common struggle, for a common victory." And the Communist International, or Comintern, was founded in 1919 by Lenin as a response to the Second International, which had led the workers into World War I by backing their own imperialist countries against the unity of the working class. And the Third International, the Communist International, was to make sure that never happened again. You would never have socialist parties essentially breaking ranks with each other and encouraging the mass slaughter of workers on the battlefields in a war unleashed by the ruling class, as is what happened in World War I, which of course was a war for competition over colonies between the great empires. But the Communist International, at its second Congress in July 1920, the Comintern gave the anti-colonial struggle wide prominence, and this emphasis would help shape the international communist movement for decades to come. The Comintern was to play a major role in building communist parties around the world in both advanced countries as well as in colonized states. Lenin's uncompromising support for the right of nations to self-determination, up to and including secession, had a tremendous impact on the oppressed countries. He is credited with adding to Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels' slogan, "Workers and oppressed of the world unite." Right? So basically, instead of just workers of the world unite, now it's workers and oppressed peoples of the world unite. That's what Lenin said. And that's what the Communist International was all about. It wasn't just about workers in Western countries. It was about the peoples of the colonies and them struggling for self-determination and freedom from colonial oppression. And the development of the Communist International also encouraged the emergence of specifically anti-racist American and South African communist parties that would lead the struggle against segregation and apartheid. The American ruling class even managed to convince itself that the anti-segregation struggle was somehow caused by a foreign communist plot. You know, and even today you have commentators on CNN and MSNBC trying to blame the Ferguson uprising a few years ago and Black Lives Matter on Russian meddling in U.S. affairs. Like, they do this. And in the same breath, they try to blame Russia for American racism. I mean, figure that one out. You know, America, of course, is a deeply racist society and was basically since it was ever founded. I mean, racism is a made in America thing. It's not a foreign import or something like that. And it was African-American communists, such as Paul Robeson, Langston Hughes, W.E.B. Du Bois, and others, who really led the charge against Jim Crow. And in the 1930s, the CPUSA even organized black workers and farm laborers in the Deep South and fought against the Klan at a time when practically every other political party in America supported segregation. You know, the Communist Party was fighting segregation. The Communist Party even supported African-American national self-determination, arguing that black Americans were victims of colonialism. You know, which is something Malcolm X used later built upon, the Black Panther Party. You know, fighting for the self-determination of African-Americans and understanding them as a colonized people within the United States. But of course, all around the world, the Communist International facilitated the mobilization of workers and peasants and oppressed peoples of all kinds. I mean, Soviets were formed in Cuba in the 1920s, you know, decades before the revolution actually triumphed in that country. And communist parties arose in many oppressed countries, including South Africa, India, Indochina, Indonesia, Sudan, Iraq, Vietnam, and elsewhere. And the anti-colonial struggle would only gain more ground after World War II, as European colonial empires, which had once seemed invincible, began to crumble. Following the Soviet defeat of Nazi Germany, almost all of Eastern Europe was liberated from imperialist rule. And in Vietnam, after the surrender of Japan, Soviets were established all across the country, and peasants seized the land, beginning the long road to independence, which would come 30 years later, after a titanic struggle against first French colonialism, and then against the Americans in the Vietnam War. In 1949, the Chinese Revolution shook the world, bringing 700 million people into what was quickly becoming the socialist camp. By 1959, there were 14 socialist countries, encompassing 1 billion people. In this period, national liberation struggles swept the world, encouraged by armed struggles in Asia, across Asia, in Algeria, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, in Africa, and in other countries. In all these places, communists were leading resistance movements that were fiercely challenged by the corresponding colonizers. When the first post-colonial countries started to emerge in Africa, the Middle East, Asia, and Latin America, the Soviet Union gave tremendous military and material support to these states. Gamal Abdel Nasser's Egypt, Sukarno of Indonesia, Jawaharlal Nehru of India, all benefited from this policy, and there were many others. By 1965, Soviet aid to emerging countries surpassed $9 billion U.S. dollars in both economic and military assistance, according to state records. This allowed these countries to carry out somewhat independent developmental policies that wouldn't have been possible within the world capitalist market. For the first time, they could trade on more equitable terms with the Soviet Union, which was not subject to the boom and bust cycles of the capitalist system, and was therefore a much more reliable trade partner. This was also true within the socialist camp, where countries such as the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Vietnam, Cuba, and Eastern Europe were the beneficiaries of Soviet economic and military aid. The United States invasion of Korea was repelled with the direct assistance of the Soviet Union. The defeat of the U.S. in Vietnam was in large part due to the military backing of the Soviet Union. And even though it never became part of the socialist camp, officially, India's first steel plant, which was handed over to the Indian government, was built by the Soviet Union. It was massive economic aid that the Soviet Union gave to India. When the UK, France, and Israel invaded Egypt in 1956, the Soviet Union assisted the country, which was eventually able to throw out the colonizers and drive them out of Egypt. The USSR would also support the anti-colonial governments in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, while allying itself with the Palestinian liberation struggle as well. The Cuban Revolution of 1959 was seen as a tremendous threat by the United States even before Fidel Castro declared socialism as the ruling ideology of the country. The U.S. imposed the all-encompassing economic and political blockade on the island, and in 1961 orchestrated an invasion at the Bay of Pigs, which was thoroughly defeated by Cuban forces. And throughout this period, the Soviet Union provided both military and economic aid to the island nation, helping it to consolidate its revolution with preferential trading terms and military hardware that deterred any more U.S. invasions. And it's important to understand that the strength of the Soviet Union and the socialist camp, you know, standing as a progressive bloc of countries for more than 70 years, that really tied the hand of Western imperialism and helped ensure the independence and development of many countries, which otherwise would not have been possible. In South Africa, the Soviet Union built a relationship with the Communist Party and later with the African National Congress, led by Oliver Tambo, who said at a conference in Havana, quote, "The Soviet Union, Cuba, many socialist countries have made it possible for many of the heads of state who are here today to survive, to win, to become leaders of independent countries. That was a crime against imperialism. We understand it." From the early 1960s, the Soviet Union provided military aid to the ANC's Spear of the Nation and to the People's Movement for the Liberation of Angola, which also fought against apartheid South Africa. It also provided military and technical training in the Soviet Union for independence movements throughout the region. I mean, so many people went from these different nations that were fighting to liberate themselves from colonialism. So many of them were able to go to the Soviet Union for training, for education, for support, that better equipped them to lead these struggles. In 1969, Kwame Nkrumah, the first prime minister of independent Ghana, went on a tour through Eastern Europe, declaring his solidarity with the Soviet Union and China. In 1962, the Soviet Union awarded him with the Lenin Peace Prize, in acknowledgement of his pan-African efforts to unite the continent against continued colonial plunder. Like many other anti-colonial leaders, Patrice Lumumba of the Congo found himself in the middle of the Cold War. And many leaders didn't want to face the hostility of the United States by turning to the Soviet Union for aid. Nevertheless, Lumumba did ask the Soviet Union for help, and it was shortly after that, in 1960, that a coup was launched, which led to the execution of the Pan-African leader. A coup at which actually Belgium, the United States, and Canada collaborated in. But in 1962, the Patrice Lumumba University was founded in Moscow for students from developing countries. The stated purpose of the university was to give young people from Asia, Africa, and Latin America, especially from poor families, an opportunity to be educated and to become qualified specialists. And this is actually something that Cuba engages in right now with training, giving free medical education, medical training to poor students coming from all over the Caribbean region and beyond. But the Soviet Union did it on an even larger scale, and at the same time paid tribute to revolutionaries such as Patrice Lumumba, who fell victim to colonialism and imperialism. Millions of students were given free education in engineering, agriculture, and other disciplines over the course of Soviet history. Millions of international students, and even the CIA acknowledged it. You know, the CIA in one of its reports actually said, quote, "The Soviets are also educating numerous Latin American and Caribbean students in the USSR, cultivating organized labor, and profiting from the growth of pro-Marxist sentiments among religious activists." And of course, all these people were targeted very murderously by the CIA throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and beyond, especially in Latin America, but in other countries as well. Where, of course, the United States was fighting and using the most brutal tactics imaginable to keep their various puppet regimes in power, which in many cases were outright military dictatorships in the case of Latin America. When the Soviet Union was defeated in 1991, it had a devastating economic impact on the countries that had once received its aid and assistance. For Cuba, it meant a special period of austerity. Vietnam was forced to let in Western capital. For India, it meant opening up to harsh dictates from the IMF and the privatization of state-owned industries. In Central America, the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front in El Salvador was forced to compromise, as was the ANC in South Africa, and the PLO in occupied Palestine. The end of the Soviet Union and the Russian Revolution saw a rise in imperialist aggression worldwide. Iraq, Somalia, Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Libya, and Syria have all been invaded by the US in the wake of its demise. The fact that the socialist camp no longer exists as a counterweight to American hegemony is a telltale sign of its importance, not only against imperialist wars, but as an inspiration and a base for socialism and liberation. And perhaps above all, what the October Revolution of 1917 inspired was internationalism, telling millions upon millions of working class and colonized peoples around the world that they were not alone, and that united they can never be defeated. I mean, this poem by African-American communist Langston Hughes speaks volumes. It's entitled The Ballad of Lenin, and it goes like this. "Comrade Lenin of Russia, high in a marble tomb, move over, comrade Lenin, and give me room. I am Ivan, the peasant, boots all muddy with soil. I fought with you, comrade Lenin. Now I've finished my toil. Comrade Lenin of Russia, alive in a marble tomb, move over, comrade Lenin, and give me room. I am Chico, the Negro, cutting cane in the sun. I lived for you, comrade Lenin. Now my work is done. Comrade Lenin of Russia, honored in a marble tomb, move over, comrade Lenin, and give me room. I am Chang, from the foundries, on strike in the streets of Shanghai. For the sake of the revolution, I fight, I starve, I die. Comrade Lenin of Russia rises in the marble tomb, on guard with the fighters forever. The world is our room. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Небо утреннего стяг, жизни важен первый шаг. Слышишь, веют над страною ветры яростных атак. И вновь продолжает собой, и сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. Весь летит во все концы, вы поверьте нам, отцы. Будут новые победы, станут новые бойцы. И вновь продолжает собой, сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. С неба милости не жди, жизнь для правды не щади. Нам, ребята, в этой жизни только с правдой по пути. И вновь продолжает собой, и сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди.
The Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRE. That was Lev Lutsenko, Soviet singer, with Lenin is Young Again. Song really praising the leader of the Russian Revolution of 1917. Now, of course, like, this isn't the only show I'm going to do on the Russian Revolution of 1917. This show, I was really just going to focus on the anti-colonial aspect of the revolution and it encouraging the various national liberation movements throughout Africa and Asia and Latin America that it did. But I mean, certainly next week, I'm probably going to get more into the history of the revolution itself, like how it actually worked out, the situation in Russia at that time, the forces which led to the revolution taking place. But this week, I specifically want to talk about the anti-colonial aspect of it. And a little later on, I'm also going to talk about the impact that it had on the struggle against segregation in the United States, because that was absolutely huge. What happened in 1917 had a huge impact on that, which is often not acknowledged today. But so we're going to look at that a little later. Right now, I'm going to play an excerpt from a talk that Brian Becker of the Answer Coalition in the United States, he's also a member of the Party of Socialism and Liberation. This is the talk which he gave on the Real News Network a few years ago about the Russian Revolution, the kind of significance that it had. And he does an excellent job at that, and I'm going to play that right now. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
What's up, world? And welcome back to another edition of I Mix What I Like here at the Real News Network. I'm Jared Ball here in Baltimore. Today, we're going to talk again with Brian Becker, who is the national coordinator for the Answer Coalition and also an organizing member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. But today, we're going to talk with him about his new book, Imperialism in the 21st Century, Updating Lenin's Theory a Century Later by the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Brian, welcome back to
Thank
the
you.
Real News.
Thanks.
So let's start with that introductory broad question. Who was Lenin? Why does this book require, why does his theory on, what is his theory of imperialism, and why does it require an update in the 21st century?
Well, Lenin was, of course, the leader of the Russian Revolution, the first socialist revolution, the first time where working and poor people not only seized power but held power, and of course that changed the face of the 20th century. That revolution spread throughout Asia and Africa, the Middle East, Latin America. It inspired poor people to think that they too could organize and change society. Lenin was also an orthodox Marxist, but Marx died before what Lenin described as the era of imperialism. When Marx was alive, imperialism was a policy pursued by, say, the Dutch in Indonesia or the British in India or other places. What Lenin said about imperialism is that imperialism had evolved from a policy of the major capitalist countries to a global system whereby the entire world was divided between the small handful of imperialist countries into colonies, semi-colonies, and spheres of influence. And that global system had become toxic, it had become malignant, because each of the capitalist economies had to continue to expand production, had surplus finance capital, but there was no place to export that capital because the entire world had been divided. And Lenin said, this will lead inevitably to war between the imperialists, and that was, in essence, his explanation of why World War I, a war without precedent in terms of the magnitude of carnage and violence, was taking place. So he wrote it in the context of World War I to explain that World War I wasn't an accident. It wasn't because the Archduke of Serbia got shot. It wasn't an incidental phenomenon, that it was an organic feature of modern monopoly capitalism.
And this was his book, Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism. Right.
So, in other words, capitalism had gone through a free market stage. It had evolved into monopoly capitalism. It was struggling to redivide the world because the entire world had, at that moment, been colonized.
Now, you talk in this book about the need to update his theory, that he was, I think it's fair to say, more or less, in your opinion, correct in his analysis of the day, but as Marxists need to do, as you also talk about in your book, Marxists don't just look to apply a strict theory of Marx or Marxism to any moment. They have to adjust it for the time and the conditions that they're dealing with. So what are the conditions now that Lenin's work at the time didn't account for or require some updating?
Right. First of all, about Marxism as an ideology or as a philosophy, it's dialectical materialism, meaning it's unlike a religious dogma where it has a timelessness. The Bible says, thou shalt not, et cetera, et cetera. In the beginning, there was the word timeless dogma. Marxism says that you derive theory based on the generalized experience of society or the class struggle, and that it must be based first and foremost on facts, and facts change. And Lenin says himself, Theory is gray, but the tree of life is ever green, meaning you have to constantly understand what's actually happening. So what's the big difference between Lenin's theory of imperialism and 100 years later when we wrote the book? Not the core assessment of imperialism, its malignancy, its desire for its drive to expansion, its domination by monopoly. That's all true, but what's different is that the world is no longer a colonized world. The world went from colonialism to neocolonialism, and also where some of the colonies have emerged as major powers. And also what changed fundamentally after World War II was the Soviet Union was joined by other sister socialist republics in the People's Republic of China, Eastern and Central Europe, Vietnam, North Korea, later Cuba. In other words, two-fifths of the planet had become socialist and became the axis of a new kind of struggle, not between the imperialists who were fighting each other for colonies, there were no more colonies, but by the imperialist world as a whole, led by the anchoring imperialist country, the United States, the only country, the only capitalist country that had survived World War II unscathed. All the rest were in smoldering ruins. But the United States rescued world capitalism and put all of the capitalist countries, including its defeated rivals, Germany and Japan, after a few minor punishments, directly in a united front with the United States as junior partners, not real competitors, as junior partners to fight the bigger foe, which at that time was the socialist governments, the socialist movements, the national liberation movements that were not only anti-colonial but socialist, because the victory of the socialist camp meant the absolute destruction of all of the capitalist countries. So there was a new axis of struggle. Instead of the imperialists fighting each other, they united under the umbrella of the United States leadership. That's what the UN was for. That's what the IMF was for. That was what the World Bank, that's what NATO was for. Uniting the capitalist imperialist countries, divvying up parts of the world market, cooperating, but carrying out a ruthless struggle against those who wanted to build socialism or build national liberation movements associated with socialism.
So as you went to update Lenin's work, you, in your book, talk about a number of the things that he got right at the time, some of the things that, again, need to be adjusted for today. One of the elements of his analysis that you focus on is what he said about banks. And I do want to talk about the 2016 elections and how banking is being brought into that conversation and what some of the candidates are suggesting be done about it. But tell us what Lenin's argument was about banks and where they have increased power or how his analysis played out and where your book looks to take off from that work and update it.
Lenin said the briefest possible definition of imperialism as a global system, not as a policy, was to say it is a system of advanced monopoly capitalism with the banks at the very center of it. Lenin's analysis was that the banks and banking capital or finance capital became the dominant sector of the capitalist class, and that all of the industrial capitalists who had in the past, say in the 19th century, been dominant were now subservient to the banks. Why? Because the banks basically, one, had control over credit, and secondly, the banks knew the exact financial situation of each of the industrial capitalists, how strong they were, how weak they were. The banks could, because of the dire need for credit, also force weaker companies to merge with bigger companies. In other words, the banks became the engineers of the process of more and more monopoly. And you can see in the United States, 100 years ago, there were 300 car companies. Today, there are three. That process of monopolization has gone on in the airlines and telecommunications, in the media, everywhere. And all of it behind the scenes being manipulated, being organized, is bank capital. And bank capital also has to be exported. So you see all of the trade pacts like NAFTA or the current TPP. Those are not really about trade. They're certainly not about free trade. They're about investor rights, and that's ultimately about the rights of banks to be able to dominate the trade policies of all countries, making sure that there's no obstacle, no impediment to capital. So what Lenin said about the banks is more true today. So we would not update that except to say he identified the trajectory of the dominance of bank capital of Wall Street, for instance, and that trend has proven to be more and more the case.
I also want to come back to this question of the difference between colonial policy or imperialism as a policy and imperialism as a system. I want to come back to that in just a second, but well, actually, let me just start there, because then we'll do it that way. You mentioned that already, but if you could just say another word or two about this difference between policy and system and where we are today. That is, where is, other than what you've just said, maybe some other examples to help identify how is imperialism as a system working now as opposed to when it was a policy a century ago?
I think the way to look at it, the starting point to understand imperialism's evolution, metamorphosis into a system rather than a policy, is to look at what happened in Africa. In 1884, there was a conference in Berlin. It was called the Berlin Conference. There were 13 or 14 imperialist countries. The United States, which was a latecomer to imperialism, was also present. But they took the map of Africa and they divided every part of Africa up so that there could be a peaceful division between the imperialists, not like World War I, which was a military struggle between them for colonies, but a peaceful decision to divide Africa. That was 1884.
Just real quick, how many Africans were at that table?
That would be zero Africans. And of course, they said it was for Africa's benefit, of course, that had noble causes. But they took the map of Africa and literally Egypt will go to Britain. You know, of course, Belgium had Congo. But the entire, within 18 years from the 1884 conference in Berlin, all forms of African governance were eliminated within 18 years. And by 1902, the only independent country left in Africa was Ethiopia. So all African governance, with the exception of Ethiopia, was gone in 18 years. That's the period that Lenin says it wasn't simply a policy by this or that country, but the mad scramble for colonies led to the complete division of the world market, which then 15 years later led to a war between the imperialists about how to redivide the world market. So, and that process replicated itself again in World War II. So what Lenin said showed that capitalism in its highest stage was imperialism, inevitably driven towards war. Now the United States also recognized, weirdly, what Lenin recognized. And they tried to develop a policy in 1943, 44, 45, at the end of World War II, to avoid World War III because it was leading to the destruction of capitalism and the triumph of socialism. As we could see, socialism gained a great deal. It was a period of revolution because of the magnitude of violence and destruction of the old social order from World War II. So what the United States said, let's have the United Nations, end the scourge of war, again, between the imperialists, not between the imperialists and those who they were oppressing in the Third World, but between the imperialists. Let's settle our differences peacefully. Let's have a World Bank. Let's have an IMF. So we, the United States, who now dominate finance capital, will decide who gets the loans. We'll rebuild Europe. We'll rebuild Japan. The deal, though, is you become our junior partners. And in your junior partnership, we give you access to markets, but you allow your countries to be occupied, and you join us in the struggle against the formerly colonized people who are aligning with the socialist camp to win their own freedom. So that was that's how that policy shifted. So after World War II, no more colonies, but you have a new empire, not the British Empire, which count with colonies, but American empire with 1,000 military bases dominating all of Africa, Middle East, Asia, Latin America, and intending to do so forever, but blocked by the existence of the socialist camp, which could be a countermeasure. Then there was, in our book, Lenin, Imperialism in the 21st Century, talks about what happened in the 21st century because the Soviet Union collapsed. It was overthrown. There were frailties and weaknesses, vulnerabilities within the socialist project. And once overthrown, the United States decided, and it was clear in their documents like the 1992 White Paper, that the United States had engaged in a new stage of imperialism, which was the period of unipolar global U.S. domination, which led to all sorts of adventures, like the invasion of Iraq, for instance, like the bombing of Libya, like in the 90s, the destruction of Yugoslavia, a multi-ethnic socialist republic.
We even just wrapped up the anniversary of the invasion of Panama a couple of days ago.
The invasion of Panama. When Bush knew that the Soviet Union was weakening, they identified all the weak links all around the world, especially countries that were emerging as independent countries. Panama, they could take that out. The next year, Iraq, because they knew Gorbachev wasn't ready to fight them because the Soviet Union was coming about. Those weren't necessary wars. Those were wars of choice. It didn't start with George W. Bush. It was like the next stage of imperialism. So you have colonialism, meaning the fully developed world, a global system of imperialism. The imperialists fight each other. Then after World War II, stage two, the imperialists unite with each other to fight the socialists and the National Liberation Movement. After conquering the Soviet Union or helping it implode, then they go on a new rampage, again, to reconquer all of the independent nationalist governments that had been sovereign under the protection of the socialist bloc. It was considered to be a mopping up operation. But of course, it turned out to be a fantasy because the people who were colonized didn't become anti-colonial because they got arms from the Soviet Union. They became anti-colonial because they wanted to be free people. They didn't want to be occupied. Iraq will never go back to colonial domination, nor will any of those countries. So the fantasy of this, the imperial hubris that went with the third stage of imperialism, actually, I believe, is becoming its undoing, which we talk about, too, in our book.
And this sort of, if going back to a previous question, is where Lenin was correct in mapping the trajectory of the advance of capitalism to where we now have finance capital dominating everything through banks. Is that
yes,
more or less what
you yes, and
there?
And the other thing you'll see when you read Lenin's book, and our book includes the original writings of Lenin, which are very important. He ends the chapter, he said, imperialism is not only dominated by the banks in this insatiable war between imperialism to redivide the world, in other words, redivide the colonies. He said there's also an element of parasitism. There's another element, which is the militarization of imperialism. That militarism, in essence, starts to have its own life. And you can see that after World War II, the United States created what was now known as the military-industrial complex. Mm-hmm. There was no existing enduring military economy before World War II, but the U.S. Empire said militarism will be the road by which we not only stabilize capitalism so it doesn't endure big economic depressions like the 1930s, the government will form a kind of welfare for capitalist corporations by giving them military contracts, $1 trillion a year at this point, that's a lot of money, but it also becomes a way to dominate the rest of the world. So you have the United States. The last time the United States was invaded was 1812, the War of 1812. That's how we can remember it. It was just 204 years ago. And yet it has 1,000 military installations and bases all over the country in 150 countries. What's that for? Not defending the United States because it's not at risk. That's to project through the exercise of militarism, imperialist domination by the banks.
Banking has come up and is looking to come up a lot more this year in the election cycle, the national presidential election cycle here in the United States. And this is something I'm personally, admittedly, struggle with, how to respond to what a lot of, I think, well-meaning people on various points on the left why they're supporting Bernie Sanders. You know, Bernie Sanders has said he wants to break up the banks. He wants to challenge their role in this country. Yet the Party for Socialism and Liberation, of which you are a representative, has its own presidential ticket, Gloria LaRiva and Eugene Puryear. I'm wondering how you, as you know, personally yourself or as an organization, are addressing this question of your analysis, Lenin's analysis, correctly leads us to this critique of the banks. Bernie is here saying he wants to challenge those banks, yet you have your own presidential ticket running.
But so the fundamental difference between the Party for Socialism and Liberation and Bernie Sanders on the banks is not the critique that the banks are bad. The difference is about the solution. Breaking up the banks and making the big banks smaller banks is a fantasy. It's a social democratic, liberal, democratic socialist fantasy. Because capitalism, as Lenin pointed out in our book, in his book, and the book we've updated, shows that it's a congenital feature of imperialism, of capitalism, to have monopoly domination and to have the domination of the banks. It's not an accident. It's not a bad policy. It's not because of Republicans. It's not because of Democrats. It's the nature of the capitalist system itself. So his program is, in essence, an attempt to reform that which is irreformable. The big banks cannot be broken up. They can be seized, though. They can be expropriated. Why should the banks, which dominate the pharmaceutical